You might see her uptown, you know, every now and then. Now I have some extra time, I hope, to, you know, get out and exercise a little bit while it's still cool enough to do that. And, you know, fix a bunch of stuff that needs fixing that I haven't got to. But yeah, it's next Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, four more days. Yeah, we're,
Short time.
Yep.
Well, I would like to say, first off, that you've been an excellent assistant, provided excellent assistance, representing the Bureau of Land Management, in my opinion.
Yes.
It's really been great working with you. You know, we, on such short notice, we can't have the mariachi band and,
It's okay, I don't really want it anyways. You know, that's part of the way that I express my views, you know, about how things are going on, because I was kind of an unlikely government employee,
Charlie,
you know,
said
25
it,
years ago when I started. You know, my opinion of the government was that it's kind of bloated and, you know, full of itself. And
where did you start at?
I started in Phoenix. I started working on a Forest Service Enterprise team. And they needed a second motorcycle rider to assist the BLM route inventory guy, who was out of Ukiah, and it was an interagency team, but it was a Forest Service team. But they got people detailed in from Forest Service and BLM, and they needed a local guy that knew the trails and could basically pick the other guy up when he fell down. And so that's what I did. And then, you know, after he had moved to a different project, and they said, well, we like you because you show up every day, you don't get hurt, you know.
And you know the trail.
And you don't get lost, you know, because I could read a map, and, you know, I was an engineer out of work, so, you know, I said, okay, yeah, I'll stay on for another 30 days. It was an emergency hire. Then they said, you know, our team actually makes a little bit of money when you're here, so, you know, is there a way you could take any classes? We could make you a student hire. And I'm like, you know, I'm 28 years old, and I'm like, I'll go take a college class in recreation. And so I did that for, I think, two semesters, and then they finally said, well, there's a term position. I'm like, term, what's that? And they're like, don't worry about it, just apply for it. Mm-hmm. And that was how I got on full time with the Forest Service. I was with them 9 years, but I worked almost exclusively with the BLM. But I sat in a BLM office in Phoenix. It was 3 miles from my house. Couldn't believe that.
Nice.
You know, yeah. Seeing as how my previous job was 40 miles from the house through the juggernaut of Phoenix. But, you know, after about 3 years of thumping rocks with motorcycles, they said, why don't you come into the office? We got work for you. Little did I know, it was route designation. I was taking the data for the inventory, but now they said, well, now that you know all the data, we want you to help us use it and apply it right towards the planning. And I knew nothing about NEPA, and I, you know, knew even less about planning. But they tolerated me and ignored me most of the time because I was this odd Forest Service person in a BLM office. But then we got a couple of plans done, you know, and then they were like, okay, well, the BLM likes you, so we're gonna direct transfer you from the Forest Service into the BLM. Same grade, basically doing the same job.
Lateral.
And they did that, they lateraled me between agencies, and were able to do that. And the rest was history, you know. In a few years, I took a leadership program, and then I just started doing some details, moved to Alaska for a few years, and I moved here. So.
Whereabouts in Alaska?
Anchorage, the state office for BLM.
Yeah.
Nice.
Saw some sausage getting made at the state level. was unimpressed.
What year would that have been?
What's that?
What year would that have been?
2016 to 2019.
Okay.
And so I came here in 2019. But so yeah, I was thoroughly unimpressed that, you know, loud talkers could go talk to their congressmen and get what they wanted and circumvent regulation.
Wow.
It was a shock to me. You know, I'd heard about it, but I never got to see it up close and personal. Hmm. And specifically, I'm talking about the Iditarod race.
Really?
Yeah, because a lot of their stuff was never permitted right. a little bit of sweetheart deals in there. Because it's kind of a big deal in Alaska.
Is that a commercial event, or is it just different groups?
There's the Iditarod Trail Committee.
Yeah.
So people make money off of it. They do. They spread that money around so much, though, that everybody loves it.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, except PETA.
PETA doesn't like it. Yeah, the dogs. No, dogs are pulling
dogs,
people.
You know,
yeah.
After a few years of that, the family went to Alaska kicking and screaming, and they left kicking and screaming.
Oh, did you know the director in Juneau, Dennis and Cheryl? I don't know his last name offhand. He was the BLM director there in Juneau area.
Juneau.
Well, BLM state office is in Anchorage, but I did not know the person you're talking about. So, but anyhow, I know I spoke a long time here, but you know, to answer Libby's short question, staying in town for a little while, for a few months, you know, maybe through the summer.
Okay.
You know, our goal is to get the kids back into school out of Tucson, so I've still got a couple kids.
So are you moving to Arizona or farther?
Arizona, we think,
Okay.
That's the front runner right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wish we had some prior notice so we could, like, give you a plaque or something that you could, you know,
not necessary,
lose.
But thanks for the thought.
Yeah.
And I was going to bring some goodies, except that I let the day get away from me, and at 5:30 I realized the time. And I wasn't, had a dress and stuff. So.
Well, we've enjoyed working with you.
Yeah, we really did.
I'm going to run up to the front. Thank somebody for the door.
Somebody was there. I heard the doorbell.
Well, they're late, so do we let them in? Or do we pay before we let them in?
They got to bring donuts.
Got to get through the metal detector first.
Could have been the phone.
Oh, really? So let's go around the room real quick and introduce ourselves. I'm Charlie Hattendorf, interim chairman. And I represent Indian Wells Gem and Mineral Society.
Well, we're going this way?
Yeah, going this way.
Okay. Gary Lucroff, Adopta Cabins.
Mary Grimsley, Gear Grinders, and do we have a sign up sheet?
Yes.
It is
sorry, it stopped.
Okay.
Hector Villalobos, Kerncrest Audubon here in Ridgecrest.
With Mark Mason, I represent Quail Forever.
I'm Steve Shaw with the Prairie Falcon Interests, and also I work with Transition Habitat Conservancy and Mojave Desert Land Trust. I live in Tehachapi, and this was one of my projects this last year. I funded the putting together these little envelopes. We gave them away to schools, all the water districts, and the public. Cool. I think we put out about 3,000 or 4,000 of them.
Oh, wow.
It's a real simple and easy type of community thing to do that they all really like, and I encourage it. I brought extra ones for everybody, so let's not leave any here except for the people in BLM.
I'm sure our staff would like
you.
To take them home too.
Thank you.
Yep.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Happy to put them in the ground.
Stephen Rainey with the China Lake Astronomical Society and also the TV Booster on the board.
John Auburn with California Breakfast Burritos.
My name is Danielle Schiller. I'm here with Public Land Matters.
I'm Tom Bukowski with BLM.
We'll get your public on the Grand Mountain.
I'm Skip Gorman, representing the city of Ridgecrest.
I'm Sam Merck, and I represent the public.
You do.
And Barbara?
I'm Libby Vincent, and I represent the Matarango Museum.
Yay!
I don't think we missed anybody. Okay, so let's see. We've done the introduction. We don't have any guest speakers. We could probably jump right in there. Yes, Sam.
Can I be very informal? It has been a while since our wonderful representative from the Raptors. Would you consider being a guest speaker next month?
Sure.
Heck, I was going to ask him to do it today. But you're not prepared. That's okay.
Well, actually, I came prepared.
Oh, well. Oh. Hey! Yay. All those in favor?
I'm rapping on raptors? I'm always kind of prepared with something, because I always have something in my back of mind, and driving up here from Tehachapi always gives me a good chance to think. Normally, I come up through Red Rock Canyon and come back through the other side, and that's closed off, I noticed. Right. I'm glad I didn't get stuck in later this evening, whatever's happening there. But there's always a lot of interesting cliffs that I look at that have not only, they have red tails and prairie falcons, which is my main interest, being a falconer. I've had a prairie falcon before and used it in falconry, which I was able to trap out here in our Mojave Desert. And so I've always been really interested in the raptors as a falconer in general, but the prairie falcon in particular. And when I first came to this group, it was to interest different groups, Drawbone Canyon, BLM, this group, into some of the needs that the prairie falcon has, because they're a unique bird. So many people never really knew that they were even around, because they disappear so quickly. And they're so camouflaged on the side of the mountains. And they just fly off. And when they fly, they look like a big pigeon. Their wing flap is not like that of a red tail or that of a Cooper's hawk or anything like that. They flap so quickly, and they're so small going that direction, that they actually look like a pigeon. So most people didn't realize that they were scaring them off. These cliffs, which were so nice backdrop to camp and to do recreational shooting. So people weren't shooting at the birds because they didn't know them, but they were camping in these areas and recreational shooting. And it only takes a couple of weekends to disrupt the breeding habits and things like that to bother them. So this is the message that I brought for so many years when I was more active in this group. I've been more active down where the nests are that I monitor. There's about seven of them. And I watch them to see, if they're active, how much they produce, and what goes on from year to year. And it's been about 16 years that I've been doing this. One of the nicest things for me is almost all of these five sites, I can practically drive right up to them, thanks to all the OHV work that has gone on out there, that I can get close enough to sit and watch them. There are a few of them are being harassed at this point in time by OHV, and I've learned over the past 16 years that these birds in their nesting will tolerate a lot more than I suspected. You can have activities really close to where they're nesting, as long as people don't stop. Normally they don't even know they're there to look at.
Right.
And if they don't stop there and shoot in that area.
Yeah.
Or if people don't go above them, they don't like to have people in. Even though I found out that they'll tolerate a lot of that. Interesting thing is that birds of prey and prairie falcons have a very high mortality rate just in nature. The first year birds that are born this year, which they're sitting on eggs right now, the eggs should hatch at the beginning of May. The babies through the beginning of June will start fledging, which they start rock hopping and learning how to fly in the wind in these places. And of the birds that are born this year, at the same time next year, only 45 out of 100 will still be alive. Mm-hmm. And that's how high the mortality rate is on raptors out there in general. Red tails, it's a little bit more the other way. 65% will live in the first year and things like that. Yes?
What causes their demise?
That's going to get to that. There are a number of things that happen. A lot of it is just failure to thrive. They haven't learned the hunting as well, and when winter comes or something like that and the game is sparse, there aren't as many lizards out, which is one of their type of prey. The ground squirrels are underground a little bit more. The birds have migrated, and if only the top of the best of the best, the ones who are playing golf, you know, in the LPGA is what's left out there. And that's just natural selection when it happens. A lot of times these birds, the way that they fly and catch things, they're moving so quickly, 60 to 100 miles an hour at a steep dive. And if they make a mistake and they hit their prey directly, it can kill them. So they have to learn the moves. They can get injured very quickly as a young bird, not knowing how to move as adept as a bird that's lived through it all. And if they get, you know, injured and they get an owie, they can't last very long. You know, if they can't fly within 4 days or so, they're going to be in big trouble. So that's part of it. An interesting thing that also gets them is great horned owls. Great horned owls are probably the biggest predator that they have out there, and they're those are the ghosts and goblins of the night. And if the bird doesn't know how to tuck itself away and you know, be like a rock, or doesn't go, or other raptors, they don't go into a tree and stay hidden in denseness or next to a trunk of a tree, so their outline isn't out there. Those birds will find them eventually, and I've seen pictures of them, you know, picking a young bird off the side of a cliff in the middle of the night.
Wow!
And they are they're pretty good out there. And out in the desert, there's you know, great horned owls. They can easily travel 10, 15 miles at a time to go to different spots that they'll check out.
I'm
pretty pleased in the last 16 years about what has happened in some of the protections of the prairie falcon nests that I've been watching. And the biggest thing has been the signs that we've put out there in the different places that mention that this is a sensitive species area. And when we can, it's on private property, we say no trespassing, we say please no shooting, and that we quote some aspects of the Fish and Game code that shows that protects a nesting raptor nest. And those signs have been very effective, as well as cleaning up the trigger trash in all these different sites. So, you know, if it's pretty clean to start with, a lot of people respect that along with the signs. Out of the 37 signs that we've put up in different places out there, and they go in pretty easy. We put them in a, you know, they're a small aluminum sign with a metal pole and, you know, bucket, a 5 gallon bucket of cement. And we just dig a hole and set that in, and it looks like it's been cemented in. And out of the 37 or so signs we put up over 10 years, only one has been taken down and one has been shot.
Oh, that's great.
And
wow.
And the rest of them have all been respected. And I think that shows a change in the users out there in the deserts. It's just not the wild skateboarders or motorcyclists or shooters out there. These are families out there, and I think the parents are showing the kids respect for this. And so I'm pretty pleased about that.
Are there prairie falcons in Nightmare Gulch?
That's it. That's out. Yeah, I believe so.
So I've seen. That's where I've seen the signs.
Yes. There's a whole bunch of different birds up in there. I think there's a golden eagle. Well, you know what's everything that's up in there. And they won't tell. But in any case, there are a lot of nests. This is the time that you actually get to see them just before they lay eggs, which was last month, because the parent, the two adults are spending a lot of time together, and the male will come in around the eyrie, which is normally a large area. It's not just one spot. It's a cliff site, and you know, maybe a couple football fields is their whole living area that they spend all their time. And part of the courtship is the male comes in with some food, and they'll fly up together and they'll transfer it in the air, And when you see things like that happen, you kind of know there's a nest nearby.
Yeah, true.
And that's in another month, once the eggs hatch, the male will become very defensive. And if you're walking traveling within, a third of a mile or so, that male will come over and start screaming at you.
Do they mimic it, give it away almost. Do they mimic like they're hurt to drive to take you away?
No, they don't.
There's some bird that does that.
There are some birds that kind of drag their leg, but no, these if you get too close, and I've taken some birds out of the nest with my license, you know, those parents will come down and dive at you. Dang. And they can get very aggressive about that. Sometimes they hit you, but that's rare. But it doesn't matter. A jet going by your head at 100 miles an hour still rattles you a lot.
So does your group help with the water guzzlers and the maintaining things like that, the habitat?
Yeah, some falconers do. Jeff Novak, a local past veterinarian in the area. He's a falconer and he raises birds and he's very active in that. Those guzzlers falconers like because it gives us a place to go out and get birds.
Yeah.
Falconers, we hunt all the same game that most hunters do, all the upland game birds rabbits and things like that. Chucker and quail, pheasants, and that all works. So the one thing I wanted to come up and mostly talk about is the reactions of ravens with the prairie falcons. And I've studied a lot with the ravens to help my friends because the ravens will predate the young desert tortoises up until they're about 4 or 5 years old.
Yes.
And up to a certain size when they can't, you know, break into the shell a certain way. And in fact, some of our desert tortoise reintroduction programs that they're looking at is they can raise desert tortoise a lot faster than in the wild.
Yeah, and then release them.
And so they can get them up to this size within a couple of years instead of 4 to 5 years. So now they're studying some reintroduction programs that they might do because of they've been studying that way. But the ravens are pretty bad, and the ravens are moving further and further out into the desert with more of our activities out there. More people are living further out in the desert because you can, you know, punch wells in or have to deliver water a lot more. There's a lot more people homesteading in some ways. And that all is bringing the areas that were normally too far away for the ravens to bother with, it's bringing their interest. And so this is affecting the desert tortoise an awful lot. And it affects the falcons a little bit too. It's interesting how they can coexist very well in their nests. And I will always find ravens nesting in the same general eyrie or escarpment as the prairie falcons, just because it's a safe place. They alert each other what's happening. Mm-hmm. But sometimes as we're getting more and more ravens, it's becoming overwhelming and they're getting to be too many ravens at some of these sites, and it's starting to maybe overwhelm, at least in my opinion, and that's what I'm studying now, is what can I do to deter the ravens from nesting in certain areas. And what I've done is taken some of the, I'll pass this around, and take a look at it and pass it to the next person. That's a paintball particle. And there is a substance called methyl anthralate, and it's the essence of grape extract. And it works on corvids, which are ravens, crows, magpies, and such, kind of like mace.
Yeah,
and it really affects them. We've been doing for bird deterrence, we've been practicing with this substance. And
John, what was it you said?
Oh, it works if you put it in your water for your equines to keep ravens from dunking things in.
And what's the name of this stuff?
Methyl anthralate.
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 And John, it was imitation grape juice?
So it is made from grape extract.
Grape extract.
Yeah,
and that's where it's made from.
Too.
Okay.
And
this applicant, does this have that chemical in it?
I'm going to explain that in a second.
Sorry, I just wanted to make sure I caught that.
And so they've been using it and studying it a number of places, and with the desert tortoise. Tim Shields, who's been doing most of our work on desert tortoises out there for our group, he's been studying making 3D models of young tortoises, baby tortoises, and setting it up with a squirting device so that when a raven pecks on it, it will spray out this stuff.
Like a sponge?
And spray out like an aerosol.
Yeah.
And it'll bother it, and it'll teach them that this is not a good thing. And his idea is to take that behavior, and that those adults will then teach all the rest of them not to do this. Yeah. Now, it's pie in the sky hope and stuff like that, and they're studying it.
Sounds like a Shark Tank.
But what I've been studying on is how to get this substance up into the raven's nest and without having to have a whole lot of people help me on ladders and stuff like that. So I've come up with this little item here and studying it, and that will fit in a paintball gun.
Oh, okay.
That's a delivery system. I got the weight just right with the little copper BBs in there.
Yeah, so what's in there is BBs.
And the sponge, this one just has water on it, excuse me. But I put the methyl anthralate on there.
Yeah.
And I practiced to see how far I can do it. And I've had a bunch of bad things happen. And finally, I had to put super glue on it to hold it together when it was bursting out of there. And the ravens, they don't care that much.
You're the guy.
It doesn't work. It's still out. I'll see what happens when they're spending more time
on
the nest.
So it's okay to shoot the ravens with this stuff. We're not actually shooting ravens.
Yes. You can do all sorts of things to ravens as long as they don't have babies in the nest. You can do a lot of things. We falconers do some bird abatement where we fly our birds, not to try and catch the ravens, but just it harasses them.
Yeah.
We do egg oiling, which we have a substance that we can spray. We have actually drones that we use that for the hard ones, but we have a long pole that telescopes that's easy. It has a camera on it.
Wow.
And a camera here.
Yeah.
And with Wi-Fi, we can, once we get it positioned, we can go and we can spray this oil on the eggs. As long as they're not hatched, we have permits with Fish and Wildlife to do that.
So I wanted to
talk. What does that do?
Oh, so the oil on there will keep the eggs from hatching. Nice way of saying it. Euthanizes
them.
Super
good. Yeah. And that's okay. Pardon?
It fills the pores in and suffocates the
everything. Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of wondered.
And they consider that humane as long as they aren't babies. And so me shooting things in the nest when ravens aren't even there, I haven't been arrested yet.
So I'm retired, and I need to pass this out to the committee. I'm retired, and I get to sit in my backyard a lot. I have been, and I noticed that ravens are nailing raptors in the sky, driving them down to the ground, driving them into trees, okay? I mentioned this to Steve earlier, and he had told me that they're not really killing them, they're just giving them a bad day. It just looks like that. Yeah, and you know, I've never heard the raptors scream before, except maybe at me getting too close to one or something.
I think they get out flying.
You would think. That's what, so I'll let Steve answer, tell you what he answers to me. And I thought, I'd never seen this before. I thought this is like terrible, and I felt really bad for the raptors. But Steve, take it away.
Yeah, so actually, it's just they're just gangs, inner city gangs. They have their territory.
Bad boys.
The raptors are very unique because they are very solitary birds. They come together as a pair, and they raise their babies, and then they drive the babies away. And so they have a lot different mental acuity. These raptors are actually like a snake or a lizard with wings. They aren't that smart. They're very talented. But they aren't that smart. They're more reptilian. They actually came from a branch of through the reptiles. It's interesting that the falcons came from the parrot family, and all the other raptors come from the passerine family.
Well, that's interesting.
And that's kind of makes those two birds very different, and part of my love for the prairie falcon. It's so unique, and there just aren't that many. Of the breeding pairs of red tails in the state of California, there's 40,000. The breeding pairs of prairie falcons, there's 4,000. And so it's not bad, 4,000 seems to work out, but it's pretty, shows how unique they are, and a sensitive group. So anyways, when the crows or the ravens mob a raptor, which was what they'll do, especially if it's caught something and it's holding onto a squawking jay, all of a sudden the sky is filled with a mob, and they just have totally different attitudes out there in the sky. Ravens, all the corvids are very social. They're the smartest birds compared to African gray or the green parrots of all the birds out there. And they're very social too. And so they're so smart, they know how to gang up. They practice this. You can see the young birds out there, you know, doing all these loops together. And then when they are around a hawk or something like that, they've been practicing this, and they're just doing it to be mean and to harass it. You will find, though, that a good pair of red tails or so will learn how to deal with it, and it won't drive them away from their nest area. I've never seen that happen. When push comes to shove, the raptor will win. Unless it's a young bird and it doesn't have its territory yet.
Steve, how big are these raptors?
A red-tailed hawk, a female is about this big.
Yeah.
A male is about this big. The prairie falcons are about this big, a little bit bigger than a big pigeon. And Cooper's hawk is like almost this, female Cooper's is about the size of a small male red tail. Sometimes it's kind of hard to tell the difference in the type of bird, because a large type of Cooper's hawk can look almost like a red tail or so, especially if they're a young bird, because the colorations are so different.
It has
a red tail,
tail
doesn't get a red tail until about a year and a half after it's been born and it's gone through its first molt.
Steve, I have a quick question, if I may, about ravens. We have lots of them out at our place, and when we had horses and the horses had watering troughs, Helen Lamb next door would feed the ravens scraps she would get from the local butcher. bones with a little meat left on it.
Yeah.
We've told her don't do that, because the ravens then would take the bones and do something strange with it. They would drop it into the water of the horse's watering trough. And
they do that with all the rabbits off the road and everything else too.
Why? That's the question. Why do the ravens like to drop things into water?
They're mean, I told you. No, I really don't know that one. I can't quite see it. It wouldn't soften up anything unless it made it was made it easier to break into the carcass. I haven't heard of that one before.
By the way, I put up a piece of metal art right in front of Denny's restaurant. You've seen it?
It's a raven art, right?
On the top is the father of all ravens mounted on a motorcycle spring.
Right.
And halfway up is the mother of all desert tortoises climbing up to do business. With the raven, because between them, they've got to solve that problem. And I just wanted to illustrate that problem for the drivers going by. Last I heard, somebody was putting out baby tortoises made out of either metal or ceramic, so that the ravens wouldn't learn that they're easy food.
Right.
And have you heard about that?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. There are a lot of studies being easier to make with 3D printers and things like that.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and that's working out pretty well. So I haven't gotten arrested for these yet, but I'll end this real quickly with the one story of I had all of this this chemical set out, and I'm being very careful because I wasn't sure how it might affect me, and I have gloves on, and I have a syringe to do stuff with it, and everything's out there, almost like a little lab there, and I have everything all set up, and it has a funny little smell, and it's dark, and all of a sudden I hear a knock on my front door, and it's so strange, and where I am, I, you know, just got my pistol, and I just had it, you know, with me, and I open the door, and there's a sheriff. And I go, oh, just a minute. And I went, put everything away. And I came back, and I said, the sheriff, and behind me is this, you know, lab set up there, and it has the paintball gun is sitting there that looks kind of funny. And he says, I just want to let you know that we have a bomb scare across the street, and we didn't want you to come out of the house for a while. And I was, my heart's going like this, thinking about, I'm going to get arrested if he looks inside here. So anyways, I'm still experimenting with it, and I enjoy ravens, and I enjoy the raptors out there. And I really have enjoyed learning from about the different groups and mm-hmm. different interests mm-hmm. from not only this group, but also friends of Jawbones out there too. So right. Thank you for including me.
Well, great. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank
for
you.
Okay. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Any last questions?
Yes.
Steve, would you be interested in giving a talk at the Matarango Museum on your work?
Well, yeah, I could do that, yeah.
Okay.
Do we have any falcons in the museum?
And the lifespan, you've been studying them for 16 years.
They have my email. I get all the stuff on this. And
Steve Shaw says it's on file. So I do the website. Do you have like an email you can share?
Well, you guys, I've always...
Put it at the bottom or something, somewhere I can find it.
Have the populations been stable over the years that you've been studying the prairie falcons?
Yes.
Good.
I've seen some different comings and going, and in fact, if anybody's interested, the one out at California City at California site is very accessible, and they've always been very active. Last year they had four babies, and there's a stage there, almost like where great horned owls become branchers moving through the they start rock hopping, and they start learning how to fly for about 5 days. It's interesting, even though the males are born, can be born later than a female, the males are the first ones to venture out by almost a day or so. It's kind of like a thing that they agree on. I'm not sure how that works. But in this particular site, I was watching them, and the first day, the first 3 days, three of them disappeared. And so something, and this is unusual for it to happen so quickly, and so something is coming around and getting them in those first 3 days. Mm-hmm. So this year, I'd like to get together a group of people and outfit them all with, we'll get binoculars and a night vision scope for them, mm-hmm. and try to get enough people out there so we can keep an eye and see really what's happening, because it's interesting.
Can you put a camera on them? That, you know, they have...
They move around so much and such, yeah. You know, because that's one of the reasons they've moved from their eyrie or within 6 yeah. feet of it, and now they're learning how to fly, and they end up down on the ground for a day or so as they try to get back.
Yeah, but so...
If I'm suspecting a great horned owl, which is just too bad, but part of the things that you learn out there. But I'll write that down for you, and we'll talk some more.
Thank you.
Steve, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
How does the Humane Society feel about oiling the eggs?
They think it's humane, and we can make a better case for the tortoise than those intrusive, mean ravens. You know. So we've worked through that. Fish and Wildlife likes it.
$6 million grant that they
in the late 90s. They don't bother us too much on this, to tell you the truth. 02 S. Shaw.
What other falcons are there in the areas?
There are actually peregrine falcons.
Okay.
They don't nest so much in the Mojave.
They're not at Robber's Roost. They used to have that peregrine falcon Robber's Roost.
Yeah, and they did. They did nest there. I've seen them up in the, around Mammoth a lot, and there's tons of them out in the, near St. George, Utah, and things like that up in the Virgin River Valley there. They are a coastal bird, and because they lived mostly on the coast and they're adept for getting seabirds, they grew up with humans. And they are very used to being around humans and along the coast and such. And so they are, they've evolved into a very tame bird. And as falconers, we consider them the golden retrievers of the falconry birds, because they're just so easy to work with. And they're so easy to train. Their natural things that they do for us come so naturally. And I think it's because they lived along the coast with humans, and that's why they nest in skyscrapers and bridges and things like that. Okay. They're a little bigger and have a bigger bird, and they go more for ducks and seabirds. They do encroach upon the prairie falcons. Of the peregrine falcons that are in California, there are now more breeding pairs than there ever were before DDT happened. And now there's about 300 breeding pairs of peregrines along our coast. So much so that we can't rescue the, they won't let the falconers rescue the baby peregrines that fall into the water, or that might fall into the water, because they say, no, there's too many peregrines and they're starting to affect the nesting plovers. And so hopefully some of the falconers will be able to take one or two birds for falconry in California, peregrines, just because we can study them more that way. Mm-hmm. But the peregrines are very healthy, and most of their nests are along the coast, but they do encroach as things get bigger. I think they're living in Las Vegas.
So last question, I think Mary had something.
Yeah, I was really interested in, you were saying that the prairie falcons?
Peregrine and prairie.
Well, the one that you're studying.
Prairie falcon.
Okay, the prairie falcons and the ravens nest on the same face.
Yeah.
Ravens are notorious for robbing nests.
Not prairie falcons. Not prairie falcon nests.
Okay, just wanted to check.
No, really.
Okay.
Well, these prairie falcons are pretty good. They know what they're doing, and they stick around there. Great horned owls are the same way. Great horned owls, I know a lot of cases. Where I grew up, we had a place where we'd go on a walk around the block. One of the families down the street, they're on a walk in the evening, and a great horned owl came and hit the side of her face and actually put the little girl's eye out, because she was defending one of these young that happened to be, you know, not up in the nest. And these raptors are pretty defensive. Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting if everybody's watching Jackie and Shadow.
Yes.
Watching Big the bear. Eagles and the ravens trying to harass them.
Yeah.
And
again, the new chicks, the ones that were born a month or so ago,
yeah.
The ravens are back.
Oh, yeah.
Ah!
Well, they'll always be there trying to sneak in there.
Yeah, they're always there.
Yeah.
Sam, this is...
Yeah, so as long as they hatch, they're, you know, but mom and dad, they don't leave them.
So any last questions for Steve? I'm sure glad you showed up, Steve.
Good, thank you.
Yeah. It would have been a short meeting.
How beautiful.
Well, great, thank you again. Now, let's see about roundtable business, new member and substitute member applications. I don't know of any. Anybody have any substitutes or new members that they'd like to suggest, or besides Steve, who resurrected himself? He's like the Phoenix. Rose from ashes.
A chemical company has to have a safety.
Going once, going twice. Okay. Next on the list, we have BLM reports.
Sure. Hi, folks.
Methyl anthracene.
So, at our last meeting, I don't remember if I mentioned geothermal leasing.
I was working.
Anybody remember me talking about that?
No.
Okay. So our state office notified us that.
We can't hear him.
Yeah.
Mark, please.
Come on.
At the California state office level, BLM, they'll be holding a geothermal leasing sale for areas all across the state.
That's right, geothermal.
We did get a nomination for the Hayweed Geothermal Leasing Area. For those of you who've been coming a while, you may remember back in 2019, we had a environmental impact statement. Actually, 2020 is when it got finished. And that geothermal leasing area is kind of on the northwest corner of the base. So COSO Junction area,
mm-hmm. Yes.
That Rose Valley area. And
so it's
and then it was subsequently, the EIS was sued. And it was adjoined with several other geothermal leases, like in multiple states. And the two issues that were settled out as part of that lawsuit was water. Obviously, you need some kind of steam, right, to run geothermal. last I heard, water's pretty scarce here. And that was one of the things that was stipulated or agreed to in the settlement agreement, was that we would study water a lot more when, as part of that geothermal development process.
Oh, okay.
And then the other was Mojave ground squirrels. So Phil Leitner, Mr. Mojave ground squirrel himself, had enjoined the lawsuit, and the BLM committed to doing more studies to ground squirrels. So those two things, we picked up on as we're, we haven't done a geothermal lease sale up there since 2020. That EIS was used to offer a couple leases. Those leases were later rescinded for some purpose that I don't know, possibly just inaction. Because you have to do something with your lease. You can't just sit on it. You have to actively spend money to the tune of $40 per acre. Researching and, you know, getting to the point of production, because, you know, it's a national resource that if we give you a lease, there's an expectation you're going to do something with it. Of course, you get to benefit monetarily, but, you know, other people get the benefit of that energy. And so in October and November, the state office is going to have a lease sale. We are processing the determination of NEPA adequacy right now based on that EIS, tearing off of that environmental impact statement for 21,600 acres that basically the Rose Valley area.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mention it because you probably wouldn't hear anything about it. Determination of NEPA adequacy doesn't have a comment period. We're just reviewing the NEPA to see if it addressed all the resource issues that we know. Well, and of course, there was an environmental impact statement done, and it's, in our terms, somewhat recent. It fell under the DRECP, so it's compliant with the current, you know, land use plan amendment. We think tribes will take great interest, you know, as they have on the base, you know, with the geothermal. Just the whole area is tribally significant to them, with
right.
Rose Valley having an area of critical environmental concern around it. So the reason that we are processing it through the DNA process, just for those of you who follow NEPA and the kinds of things that we approve with this lower level of analysis, a lease is a piece of paper. Basically, it's like a mining claim for leasing. You know, you're bidding on the right to hold the exclusive right to go in and research and explore this area. And it doesn't give you any ground disturbing power. It's kind of like, you know, holding a mining claim so you can keep others out. But as soon as they propose to do something that's service disturbing, then we do more NEPA. And that's what that second down the road phase is, what's going to kick off more intensive groundwater survey. What I envision would be a proponent driven Mojave ground squirrel survey, you know, where they bring in folks like Phil Leitner and continue to study the squirrels. That area is known to have Mojave desert tortoise as well, in the southern reaches, you know, southern part of Rose Valley. So anyhow, that's kind of the the juiciest thing that we're doing right now. We're looking to renew gravel pit lease for our contract for T-Rock north of the Trona Airport. That's a pit that's been idle for a few years. No change to the existing boundary on it, just basically giving a new contract to take more material out of there. Interestingly enough, San Bernardino County Public Works, they don't have their own pit. So they're interested in the opening of that pit because then they can purchase materials from there. Because currently San Bernardino County has to truck in their materials from far away. Like I've heard as far as 100 miles. Which is crazy because it's, you know, if you know anything about, you know, moving sand and gravel around, it's really not economical to move it more than about 30 miles. So it's, you know, because the cost of trucking and labor and all that is just prohibitive beyond that point. But Trona's in that kind of weird spot where they don't have a lot of roads, not a whole lot of places that you could go to get gravel. So, you know, so that should be good for the availability of sand and gravel in the area. You know, other realty things. We continue to bump along with the TLRR projects. Those are the transmission line rating remediation projects where the lines will be raised up so there's not arcing coming to the ground. And there's an Ivanpah to control project. That means Ivanpah being out on I-15, you know, out towards Ivanpah Dry Lake. Kind of making a dog leg somewhere around Highway 58 and then coming up the 395 corridor. That thing's been kicking around for the whole time I've been here, I think, 7 years. And then there's the one that goes from Bishop out to the Nevada line. TLRR control Silver Peak. So that one got stalled because there was the BLM and the Forest Service were really questioning whether or not that line was really needed because the main power user is the Forest Service with their communication site out by the what's that ancient forest at the top
of Bristlecone.
Bristlecone, right. There's a research center up there. Right. It's a big comm site at the Forest Service and some others use. And that was like the main power source. That is the power source there. But then that line continues on and it was a very old, like 100-year-old power pole line going out towards Dyer. And that's what was being proposed to be up, you know, not uprated, but rebuilt and raised. And so CPUC, California Public Utilities Corporation, and the Bureau and the Forest Service kind of went round and round about whether or not Highway 6 should be the route and not go through that area because the Bristlecone Forest, there's sage grouse habitat way up high, and then the BLM has a sensitive area for cultural resources. That the power line basically goes right through, and we've had trouble with SCE, you know, not following process. So we're like, does it really need to be there? Well, that process is finally moving ahead. There won't be a Highway 6 alternative, but anyhow, for those of you who follow those things, you might hear something. Honestly, I don't know that they're going to go to another public comment period, but anyhow. I just mention it because I know it's one of the major projects we have out there. I will say that on our staffing, so with me leaving, you know, that puts us down to about 50% strength. Where we're going the wrong way on staffing. We just can't hire new people. So the approach has been a, well, let's lock arms with the surrounding offices around the state, you know, and we're taking bits and pieces of other people's offices, you know, and cobbling together, you know, like I was heading up a minerals interdisciplinary team, and our Our state office was supplying the air quality and the hydrologist. The California District Office was supplying the planning environmental coordinator, the NEPA guy, and the biologist. Barstow is supplying the archaeologist. The team's geologist was he is the deputy district manager from NorCal up in Redding. So, you know, kind of the bad news bears of interdisciplinary teams. But it actually worked fairly well because, you know, I've managed teams for a while, and, you know, you just task with people and put the expectations on them. And,
So by June for the WEMO lawsuit, by June you have to have a monitoring plan.
Right. So that is being led from the state office.
Ah, okay.
I won't talk a lot about, you know, what they're planning to have in it, but what I presented last month, you know, after Randy with the maps and such, you know, we're going to put more meat on the bones with how we're proposing to keep an eye on those things.
Okay.
I think a lot of the hope is that if we can put before the judge more about the planning, you know, that monitoring won't be as critical. You know, it won't be viewed as tightly, but that's for the lawyers to kind of advise on.
Okay.
But what's interesting is I know a lot of people wanted the Bureau, or more like Department of Justice, to appeal the ruling. I have not heard through BLM channels that we appeal. How
is that my fault?
Not mine.
I don't got that one. It's over here.
Ain't mine.
Okay, everybody check them.
Not mine.
Turn them in.
Can I just step on it now?
Just throw it out.
Hey, it's Sam.
Sam found it.
No. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, it belongs in Disneyland.
Sam first.
All right, Sam did it.
So,
it was my alarm.
A lot of people wanted to yell and
wake up.
Time to get up.
There's a meeting. Sorry.
Excuse me, you guys.
I have not heard through BLM channels the DOJ appeal. A friend did send me a snippet, like a public post from Blue Ribbon Coalition.
DeCorva has it online now.
So I've seen that they urged, you know, there was a groundswell of support to urge the DOJ to appeal.
And it's not an appeal. They left the option to appeal.
I can't think.
And
of
so they had to come. Yeah, they had to come up with the to. They'd either had to say that they're going to, you know, accept it, or maybe not. And it's so they said maybe not.
Defensive.
But they
notice,
still haven't done it.
Defensive notice of appeal.
Yeah. So it's like it just leaves the door open.
Some legal wrangling.
And that supposedly just leaves it open for them to be able to appeal it later.
Right.
I see.
Right.
And Blue Ribbon is trying to get on board. As a
intervener.
Like Randy mentioned, you know, the designation criteria that we follow, they're interested in changing that, and the executive orders that back the regulations that actually multiple agencies have. Forest Service uses a version of the same regulation. It's all based on a 1972 and 1979 executive order. When OHVs were called ORVs, and mm-hmm. you know, nobody had mufflers, and annoying kids down at the end of the street, you know, howling their bikes until, you know, the dawn, break of dawn.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of groundswell of support for regulating that industry back then. So, you know, at this point, the BLM will just continue to seek funding to get on with the planning, because as Charlie correctly put on here, you know, by October 2029, we're supposed to be through the replanning.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting enough, there are kind of two trains of thought on this.
And you probably need to hire people to do this, don't you?
Well, what's likely to happen, money will come, we'll hire a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
Or contractors.
Mm-hmm.
We can do a lot with contractors. There are some authorities to rehire annuitants, you know, basically retirees, people with knowledge to come back in. You know, there are things like that that can happen to make it, you know, go smoother. But the big problem right now is if we do the same thing, will we get the same outcome? Right, if we use the new science that we're told we didn't use,
so what's
going to change?
Can you add a little to that topic? What was the new science? Can you just generally speaking, what was the lawsuit? What was the new science that?
So the new science that I have seen that came in basically like in the middle of WEMO 2. The new science is route density.
Route density.
Yep, for tortoises. And it was a USGS study headed up by Avril Murray. Roy was a well-known researcher in Arizona when I was there with Arizona Game Fish, and he got the job at the USGS doing a lot of research for tortoises. And what he did was he created new science based on other, more like a study of facts. There are other areas where endangered tortoises live, and they looked at these areas and they looked at the route density and compared it to the health of the species. Okay. And the conclusion they came up with is not unlike grizzly bears, right? You may have heard grizzly bears. They created a science study that said, you know, if the route density is this, it's good for bears, but if it's higher than that, it's bad for bears. Well, they did the same thing for tortoises, basically. And the magic number, for some reason, always comes out to one linear mile of route per square mile. It was maybe slightly less, maybe 0.95 or something like that, because they did it in the metric. But so that's basically the, I think, the standard that the critical habitat is going to have to really look at. I'm not an ologist, but I did see that study probably a year or so ago. I don't know a lot of people were cued into it. Obviously, the plaintiffs were, because that was what they wanted us to use. And so, anyhow, I was not involved with WEMO 2.0.
Yeah, it gives me something to look at.
Yeah. You can probably find it. It's a USGS study on tortoise population versus route density.
Yeah, route density. And
so, right. You know, for a lot of species, that's kind of the holy grail, right, is to hold a piece of paper that says, you know, this is the threshold under which, you know, the species can't survive.
Right.
You know, I do think that recreation is also important. The question is, can recreation and, you know, tortoises coincide?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we have tortoises in the Spengler open area,
mm-hmm.
and yet, you know, we were not challenged on open area decisions. So, go ahead.
How does this currently affect the OHV programs and the OHV funding?
Right. So, on the WEMO suit have also, you know, they've taken their suitcase to the California OHV Commission, and we are not getting ground operations grants for the areas that are within the WEMO lawsuit. So we pivoted to spend more of our time, you know, working on areas north of Ridgecrest, you know, Panamint Valley, our open areas. We are still getting law enforcement money and restoration money for those areas that are, you know, were contested because they're not, you know, they're beneficial for tortoise, basically.
Okay, so your OHV grants haven't dropped in half or anything like that, or?
No, okay. We just pivoted and we're working in areas. We have 1.8 million acres, you know, we have a lot of cops, you know, they do a great job, but they're hungry.
But, Steve, the real bad news is that there's a lot of communities that are adversely hit because they rely upon OHV funding to bring the people in with their OHVs, to buy the gasoline, to buy the food. Ransburg, for instance, I don't know if you've seen the map or not, but Ransburg is in a hole all by itself. It has no OHV
roots.
I know
all about them, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I'm just saying, in answer to your question, it isn't the OHV funding we're so concerned about, it's the access that's for everybody.
And Steve, how it's going to affect you is if you want to drive your vehicle on
yeah.
dirt.
Yeah, to go look
west
at
of
Cal the area.
You're going to have to wait a couple of years.
Even if I have a street license vehicle.
Yep. Because our definition of off-highway vehicle is such that any vehicle, designed for or capable.
So
of
then what are the what are called the open roads? Anything that was on a topo map up until 1965?
No, there's this. The yellow is the administrative and
you can get an e-bike.
Law enforcement type of roads. People with pedals.
An e-bike with pedals.
A special permit or access to public. Private land. Things like that. On here, It's very limited. We have to demonstrate to the judge why those roads should remain in a limited status, because these are for non-OHV also. We have a bigger map out on the table.
Gotcha.
Out here, you're welcome to...
Do you have more of those?
Yeah, you can take this one. We have several of these out there.
Okay.
This one is the Rand Mountain Mansion area, which was one of the requirements in the judge's remand.
Mostly the Fremont area, Hinckley.
Was there more for the BLM report besides WEMO? Because I'd like to really go into talk more about the WEMO. Did you have more about BLM reports that...
Yeah, I can't think
about
of much
conglomerate
right now.
Mesa.
Okay, we got a conglomerate Mesa question.
Oh, right. So the decision was released probably within the last month or so, and so now the decision is out. It's going to be a helicopter operation.
With water.
The Mojave Precious Metals has to submit and has submitted back. An amended plan of operation that explains, how they're going to do their operation. And then our next step is we'll give them a decision on the plan, which lets them know we've accepted the plan of operation, what conditions we might have put on it, and then what the reclamation cost estimate is going to be for that.
So is that use of helicopters for water?
The helicopter operation to bring everything in.
Wow.
No road building.
But it didn't say in the plan where they were going to get the water at, only that the helicopter was coming from Lone Pine.
It's expensive.
I just got the revised plan of operation, so I don't know.
I read the whole thing.
No, it's a new one. Because the decision, the BLM's preferred alternative did not match the plan of operation that they submitted. They had to submit a new one now that the decision is made that now matches the decision.
Okay.
So they have to change the plan of operation,
yeah.
And I don't know if it's contained in there.
Freaking Raven.
So,
nobody wants to do anything about that.
Yeah.
Because
I'm not sure if their answer has changed, whether or not they're going to tell us, but it's going to need to be from a permanent source.
Because they just sit there and wait.
Inyo County is watching.
Yeah.
Yeah. About where the water's coming from. Now they're going to use about 5 to 10% of what they were originally proposing to use.
Yes.
So,
I read that, but it didn't say what source.
Right.
Are they going to be mining, or are they still exploring?
This is just exploring.
Yeah, it's just for just
22
drilling.
Sites. They're going to build timber platforms on the hillsides.
Yeah, they're going to drill there.
They're gonna drill, but all the pieces of the drilling operation are gonna be flown in.
Mm.
So they're gonna fly in a compressor. They're gonna fly in the drill.
Prefab.
Mud tank. They're gonna fly all that stuff in, and then they're gonna move it from place to place. So when they're done, they'll take the timbers out. So
I have a quick question. How do they actually account for where the tortoises are? Do they have an air tag on them? There's one.
Yeah. So in what situation?
To track where they're at. migration, wherever they go.
You mean when they do the studies?
Yeah, how do they know where they're at? I mean,
they walk out, they're only out during the daytime. And
not like they have an air tag on them. They say, there's one there.
No, they go out there and they walk.
Actually.
Yeah,
USGS does track.
They're watching. They're watching them go.
But not all.
So there's actually tortoise trails. That's the one that kind of route management or route planning for, you know, all the tortoises I've seen just kind of go. Just kind of like, go.
They have territory. And you can very well.
Some do for long term tracking and behavior.
They cache that information and then they bring it back. It ain't live, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Anyways, they're using them for studies, but in general, they just have people get out there and walk during the month that they are very active, which is March and April.
Right.
It's dependent by the area on what the temperature is
and
what they'll come out in the morning. But then as you walk through, it's very easy to identify their burrows. And we have you hold a little mirror there and the sun goes in there and you can tell how active a burrow is. And you have a rating scale for that. Mm. And so then we know how many active burrows are in an area and come back. And then in the active time, you have people walking, you know, this far apart. And they just go back and forth all day long.
Like a fog walk down.
Yeah.
So I got to ask, Kaz, has anyone thought of using LIDAR, which they have a portable version of it now, and it can only for to find out where the nest might be.
So actually, I've thought of two things because I come up with strange ideas.
Yeah.
and
a miniature LIDAR.
And one is that if you just shoot. Flew a drone over there, taking pictures, and using AI, which we already do that for counting sage grouse out there. You know, AI shows us a plot, and it'll pick out the sagebrush, the sage birds, and count them for us. We could do the same thing with tortoises and do that. Most of our areas, though, were under restrictions because of the Air Force base out there, but we could still get it done.
Another
idea I have is tortoise sniffing dogs. And that you take dogs out there and they could find them real and sit there and alert and you can find them a lot easier.
That's true. Look, the tails go up.
Okay. And that's related to WEMO, to this old WEMO thing.
Yeah.
So
what's interesting is it doesn't matter which side you're on, the data is really needed.
Yes. Right, exactly. That's the point of science,
They've gathered all the data that, in my humble opinion, they've gathered 90% of the data that they can get by observation. Now they got to get hip and get some technology to get telemetry to get that data.
So if I could be so bold as to move it along and just, there's a topic that I think is really important. And it's a public lands roundtable topic that we really have to address. What we're going to do about this issue moving forward. This issue I'm talking about is our potential answer to WEMO 3.0. Answer being encompassing all of us as representatives of varying interests. We should be able to come up with some kind of commonality, I think. And if you remember from the last meeting, we were almost, let's just say, entreated by Randy, pointed out the fact that many great things have come out of this group in the past. The BLM needs our input. That's probably the thing that should get all of us considering about what's going on here. And Tom too, you know, mentioned science is what's, they need ideas. And I think we could come up with something. And maybe it'll be in the form of a letter, maybe it'll be, or several letters. I would like to think that we're going to have I don't want to talk about it in terms of subcommittee, and I don't want to bore everybody to tears over this either, because I was there for WEMO 1.0 in the very beginning, and I thought everybody was just, you know, the route, what Randy was talking about with the route identification stuff. Oh my goodness, it was, these people were just really sweating and doing it as hard as possible to define where routes were, whether it was a route or not. It would rain, and then they would fly an airplane over and go, that's not a route anymore. And then, you know, and everybody would argue about it. And then there were people on motorcycles that they hired, you know, a couple on motorcycles had a great job. They went on every road they could find and with GPS. There was all sorts of ideas, right? So, I mean, we got lots of information, but I got to ask some questions. I'm sorry, just to get an idea about where we're going to go forward. And based upon, and if you haven't done it, I humbly ask you all to listen to the audio from the last meeting. And it's online, it's on the website, and it's pretty clear. You can hear Randy speak, you can hear Tom speak. And towards the end of what they say, after we're interrupting them and all that, me, whatever, you can hear them say, these are the ideas that we think you should think of as a committee, as a group, to going forward. And I tried to summarize these real quickly, if I can be so bold. You know, one is to request an update to the minimizing criteria that to include advocating recreation. And I'm summarizing what Randy had said, but apparently the four, and Tom, Tom had mentioned there's four criteria, but the minimizing criteria was one of the delimiters, one of the filters that they used for defining areas. And I can't speak to it very well because I don't know enough about it. However, it does not include advocating for recreation. And that's something that should a sane review of minimizing criteria today, we could advocate that. We could say it should include that. And we should look at these, that should be a criteria, that should be a part of the decision tree criteria. Just an idea, folks. Okay, so these aren't my ideas. I'm summarizing what the audio said, in my opinion. But you should also get your own opinion, too, by listening to the audio, okay? Then we can talk about this at the next meeting. Another idea that I thought was represented was requesting a legislative review to revisit the lines of critical habitat, because smaller communities are under such duress. And the severe economical impacts that we've heard all about with Randsburg also applies towards California City and to other desert communities and to Ridgecrest as well. I'm sure we could come up with some, even though we do have the advantage of having OHV areas close by. You know, it could be argued that, that more OHV are being channeled into these areas where they've been open before in other areas. And so it's going to be adversely impact our economy as well here in Ridgecrest. So, I mean, that's another thing we can think of, is revisiting those lines of critical habitat. We could be requesting this. And finally, review of the overall ACEC areas and their resource management plans for each, and those plans in themselves. This has been in WEMO 2.0. I was looking at it online. Couldn't sleep one night, right? And there's really a lot of information for each and every area and I'm not sure how those areas were drawn up originally, but they're more or less geographical areas, and they talk about, at least in the land management plans, they talk about resources that are in there that include recreation, that include, like Burl Schmidt's Tunnel was mentioned, and things, you know, that draw a person into that area that the BLM had received in public comments. And so they stuck this stuff in there and said, oh, look, you know, we're going to have to add that. We're going to have to consider this as a... So my question, Tom, you know, I don't know enough about this, but in the WEMO 2.0 that I read online, and I think it was in the... it was a BLM website, NEPA site, I believe. But it stated in the appendixes, it stated land management plans, if I got that right, instead of resource management plan. Are those the same thing? Are there separate resource management plans?
There are some step-down plans for ACEC's thinking of the Pinnacles.
Uh-huh.
It has a special management plan.
Yeah,
so there are some of those ACEC management plans as well. Those should be all part of those appendices.
Yeah, okay. And that's what I was...
Reading them gives you an idea of what management's already in place that this route designation is supposed to follow.
Right.
And you'd probably be surprised at how onerous a lot of it is and kind of, you know, already kind of puts, you know, driving vehicles at a kind of disadvantage.
Right.
So.
I was going to say, are those ACECs and those other areas that you mentioned determined by the BLM or by fishing game?
By BLM. However, as part of the scoping process, people can propose.
Some of them are anthropologically, you know, set up. Fish and Wildlife doesn't deal with they are set aside because of that. So there are a number of different jurisdictions.
But don't they set up the ACECs?
Not Fish and Wildlife exclusively.
Don't they?
The BLM, it's a BLM planning tool.
Right.
It's actually the one restrictive allocation that we do at land use plan that is actually named in FLTMA since 1976.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why it has such power. And so each of them has its relevance and importance criteria that's what people nominate, you know, people to advocate for a particular thing. Mm-hmm. Like we have ACEs that are for wildlife. We have some that are for cultural resources, whether it be historic or pre-contact.
Mm-hmm.
Don't they have to come through a congressional direction, or can it come up from the ground up?
They're from the ground up, mostly. I don't know that Congress really gets that much involved in land use planning, but
for designating an ACE, I thought that hadn't come through legislative.
Well, I've seen it done locally.
No, Congress told us that was a tool we could use.
Good.
They told us that in our Enabling Act, Organic Act in 1976, FLTMA. So, understanding the various pieces of those ACECs, because this WEMO 3.0 is its goal is not to amend the land use plan, it's to implement it. So we're not looking to change these ACECs. As I call them. I call them sideboards.
Okay.
Because, the ACEC, it says that, this is the goals for this area,
right?
Basically, and if the goals are wildlife and not recreation, well, recreation is going to take a back seat to wildlife management, and that implies reduced number of routes, not advertising it to be a high use area, things like that.
Okay.
And
so, would the criteria have changing that? Would that have anything? Would recreation still be at the bottom of the barrel always, no matter what? I remember it's not in the DRECP also.
Yeah. Well, let me read you the four criteria, because you probably never heard it.
Go for it.
So there's A through D, and this is from 43 CFR 8342.1.
Okay, just a second, please. 43 CFR.
8342.1.
Okay, thank you.
8340 is our off-road vehicle management series.
Okay.
A, areas and trails shall be located to minimize damage to soil, watershed, vegetation, air, or other resources of the public lands and to prevent impairment of wilderness suitability. You know what's happened since 1980 when these regulations were done?
Yeah.
We're basically done with wilderness suitability. I mean, we've got tons of wilderness areas and only a few WSAs left, at least in our area.
Wilderness study areas.
Yeah. But the first part of A means that you need to protect the environment first. The problem is that we didn't build half of our routes. We would have considered them in different locations had we done that. So, we're already kind of at a disadvantage because we're either going to designate an existing route or we're going to designate it and we're going to say, well, we'd like to move that route, over time to make it more environmentally sustainable. That's a possibility. It also commits a lot of manpower and time to doing that. But anyhow, I just want to mention that the A is kind of the catch-all. Then B, it says, areas of trails shall be located. It's always this located thing in here. We didn't locate them. We got all the routes given to us by miners, ranchers, the military, campers,
desert tourists,
topo maps.
The number of routes that we actually built, for BLM purposes, very few.
Right.
So anyhow, but just understand how the regulations read. Areas and trails shall be located in officially not be located and officially, I'm sorry, I skipped ahead to D. Yeah. Whoops. Areas of trails shall be located to minimize harassment of wildlife or significant disruption of wildlife habitats. Special attention will be given to protect endangered or threatened species and their habitats. Ding, ding, ding.
Right.
So, you know, if you have a long road and you have a very short species and they can't see across the road, it's like the Great Wall of China.
Yeah.
You know?
Put up a fence. Okay.
And so, yeah, and so some of, you know, some of the routes,
which are dumb,
they get used a lot and it creates a barrier. And that's what that's trying to tell us, is there are areas that are more important than others for wildlife. C, areas and trails shall be located to minimize conflicts between off-road vehicle use and other existing or proposed recreational uses of the same or neighboring public lands. Mm-hmm. Kind of nebulous.
Yeah.
And to ensure the compatibility of such uses with existing conditions in populated areas, taking into account noise and other factors.
Okay.
So it's kind of saying, BLM, don't designate a bunch of roads right next to the neighborhood. D, areas and trails shall not be located in officially designated wilderness areas or primitive areas. Primitive areas is a term that BLM doesn't use anymore, but right. You know, there used to be this thing called primitive areas.
Okay.
Areas and trails shall be located in natural areas only if the authorized officer determines that off-road vehicle use in such locations will not adversely affect their natural, aesthetic, scenic, or other values for which such values are established.
Yeah, so somebody can complain about every route everywhere.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, everything.
So the question is, you know, if two people have the same vehicle and it meets a sound standard, is behavior then, you know, or intent now the determining factor of whether or not the authorized officer is going to determine whether or not it's detrimental to the aesthetics in such an area?
Yeah.
That's kind of the age-old question, right, is who gets to use it, what's their intent, is the speed difference, you know, a factor, you know, because how we market things actually matters. You know, there are areas like the like Panama Valley. I mean, we don't allow racing there. You know,
right?
People can go there. There's a lot of long roads, but the road density is not real high. Mm-hmm. Probably never has been. Mm-hmm. And you know, just doesn't attract the racer crowd. Mm-hmm. So anyhow,
I keep hearing the word in these regs and these discussions, OHV and OHV, and I consider that one of the biggest impacts. But I don't know if it's the same as most of our members here, which you might call it recreation, but you know, search and rescue. You guys, you mostly, and most of us, you know, use licensed vehicles. Like back in the 70s when I went out with my dad, we took our four-wheel drive truck out there. We went up to the mines and such. And we followed topo maps, and we'd see hunters out there and rock people and other users and things like that, and some people on motorcycles and things like that. And I don't think this suit applies to us.
Actually,
I don't believe that they can stop me in my licensed vehicle from going out and going hunting in an area, or to go up to some area of a mine, and on a road that was on a topo map in 1970.
Well, I agree.
And so I believe that it's not going to have the same effect. I don't think they can police it as long as we don't have a green sticker.
Well,
and that's what it comes down to. And I think they're going to have an awful hard time. They're going to have to arrest me a number of times. I can tell you that.
So back in, you remember California Desert Protection Act, and when, you know, Alan Cranston and, you know, Diane Feinstein coming in, and she used the figures for the people in, you know, going on I-15, going to Las Vegas, saying that there's all these millions of people going into the Mojave Desert, and you got to close it down, and so that started that whole thing, okay, and it was bogus, right? Yeah. It was erroneous. It was, But it worked.
The other issue I wanted to bring up is that I've been involved with a lot of sports and activities that that was really fun and it was exciting, but it's had its day. I mean, the endurance horse racing, of which we had have events out here.
Yeah.
And those, you know, we keep getting more and more restrictions on how to do things.
Right.
And so we're having less of those events. And the sport is being choked off itself. And some things have their time.
Right.
And I tell you, from what I've seen out there and been annoyed by the OHV crowd, I think it maybe it's... I'm sorry for some of the small communities, et cetera, but some things have their day.
Yeah.
You know, the train doesn't come through this place anymore. It's just sometimes things go through their changes. And mm-hmm. I think this may make a big change on OHV use.
Mm. I think we need to put no more sales on side-by-sides.
I know. Well, that's one of the biggest problems that I've seen out there.
That's right. He's right.
We did.
The problem is during COVID, every idiot bought a side by side.
Yeah.
They couldn't drive on the freeway, and now they're out of control in the desert.
Yeah.
And it's embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, they really do.
Yeah. But that's the thing. Not everybody's bad.
They really do turn into a race car.
Let me blow your mind with the definition of an off-road vehicle. From 43 CFR 8340.0-5. Mm-hmm. A, off-road vehicle means any motorized vehicle capable of or designed for travel on or immediately over land, water, or other natural terrain, excluding, and it's just next to a list of a motorboat, any military fire, emergency law enforcement vehicles while being used for emergency purposes. It's the exclusions. Any vehicle whose use is expressly authorized by the authorized officer or otherwise officially approved, so, you know, rights of way holders, people like that. Vehicles in official use, so when I go out and drive the BLM truck, I'm not an off-road vehicle.
Right.
And then the most recent change has been e-bikes, as defined in paragraph J of this section.
Buy one.
And so they took e-bikes and they said e-bikes are not off-road vehicles.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's like and the last one is any combat or combat support vehicle when used in times of national defense emergencies. So if we have to unleash the tanks,
oh my Jesus,
sorry tortoises, all bets are off. They're off-road vehicles. they're defending, you know, the very place that tortoises live. So
right. They've
been excluded by Congress.
So please listen to the audio one more time.
Hello.
At the next meeting, I would just like to suggest that we think about this. We come up with a plan. We decide how you would like to see us answer this. And we really need to orchestrate an answer. We might have a couple of years. It might only be till October 29. But I think it's important for us to have to be prepared to be, because the something could come up. A request for comment could come up at any time. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sooner we get into planning, the sooner we'll finish.
Okay.
I know that we're looking for funding. Washington has to cough up funding, basically, to help us get through it. Because, you know, these planning things are expensive when you bring in a contractor to run it. The question is, will it be another environmental impact statement,
right,
you know, covering the 2,200 miles? Or will we change the approach and do smaller plans that are more focused on a particular place? You know, when I was in Arizona, I did four travel management plans, none of them over 600 miles.
It kind of makes sense to have a smaller area, piecemeal,
you know, and
but
now,
whatever.
In our area, we have less than 500 miles that are affected.
Sam, you had something?
Yes. In 1993-94, there was a plan that the BLM put together for the Randsburg area. It was never implemented. And the reason is because we had the desert bill that came in.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, it grew into WEMO, NEMO, NECO. And so all those things came crashing down. In the meantime, this Randsburg plan stood out there, and nobody really accepted it, and it was never submitted to the judge. And so we need to look at that and incorporate it. Also, another thing, too, a lot of the utility roads in this area are used by, you know, SCE, whatever. Our astronomy group uses plenty, you know. And then on top of that, we have satellites that we need to repair and work on. You're involved in that. And so our communication for this area is very dependent. We also have people that live in remote areas, and their only access is to go through the desert. That's where their property is. So we really have to put our thinking caps on, and we really need to come up with some good ideas. But I agree with Charlie. We need to do something. We can't just sit here. We all enjoy the desert for lots of different reasons. Your burros and horses come from the desert.
Right.
You do the guzzlers.
Yeah.
You do astronomy. You go out and look at birds. You know, the Mataranga.
Rock collecting.
They collect flowers,
right.
Rocks and minerals. Search and rescue.
Yep,
and
cabins.
We're all sitting here.
Yep.
We all represent these groups. And on top of that, oh, by the way, thank you for helping the children today. They all came to the Mataranga.
Oh.
I got pictures of little kids.
Oh, they love it.
Tom, what is the most effective way that the public or our group can have input on this? Is it, you know, writing a letter just seems so futile. Even 100 letters seems so futile.
No, I see what you're saying.
Can we sue? Or is that
right? If you're the University of the United States, to whether or not the merits are there, you know. The point is, I think you're asking is, you know, if you want to color within the lines and do the, you know, your best in planning, bring forth a proposal that, you know, that works, because you know we use alternatives in our planning to try to present, you know, a reasonable range of alternatives.
Cool.
And you know, well, what is that? I mean, Steve, you mentioned that as a young hunter, you know, you enjoyed, you know, slower paced areas. And then when the off-road race face guys come in, you know, a lot of that's lost. And in recreation research terms, that's called asymmetrical conflict. Because the racers don't mind that you're there, but you mind that they're there. And that is the hardest thing in recreation. You find it, hikers hate trail runners. Trail runners don't like horse riders because of the road apples. You know, there's always somebody that's a villain in every of the recreation groups.
Yeah, that's true.
And the question is, how do you smooth that? And how do you blend that? There are focus areas, right? The off-road open areas that we have here in town, those are a California anomaly. You will find almost no open areas in Arizona. So this route designation that they have to do has to, because they don't have those safety valve areas, they have to accommodate some of that. Because they're racing on limited routes.
You know? Utah has a very open system, like California does, don't they? And mostly, is it mostly because
of
national forests?
Their land use plans have closed a lot of their open
okay.
areas. Yeah, they do not have the amount of open areas that they used to.
Okay.
But they still have some.
Because they do a lot of hunting back there, and they really have a lot of areas open for hunting purposes.
Yeah. They're also, you know, ground zero for lots of lawsuits and stuff right now.
Right, but they don't have the same desert tortoise issue that is really heightened here.
Not completely. Southern Utah does have tortoises around.
St. George.
Yeah.
And that's a big high trail use area too.
Rebecca first, Mary?
Yeah, the one thing I want to clarify as far as the side-by-sides, what we need in California is a speed limit. I don't know how we enforce it.
A governor on the car.
Yeah, but that's the problem.
Kicks in at about 70.
Yeah, this guy repairs it.
I agree.
But the part of the problem is there's no consequences.
It's hard
when you
to
get
please.
Caught riding on all the wrong places, there's really, the consequences are nothing. Mm-hmm.
So far, and that's because it isn't
like marijuana cultivation.
Well, it's always been that way.
Yeah.
The dirt bikes take the red routes, and nothing really happens to them when they get caught. That's why they keep doing it. There's no consequences.
So let's think about what we would propose. I'd just like to throw that out there.
Can you mass produce those pepper balls?
I'll even leave the room if you want.
What was that, Tom?
I'll even leave the room if you want.
No, that's good.
I just wanted to say something to you, Tom. I know I just met you, and I may never see you again. But I've been listening to you, and I had to take a note. This asymmetrical conflict is going to last me a lifetime. Brilliant. Thank you for sharing.
Just read Recreation Conflict Studies. There's a million of them out there. Every college professor that
yeah.
just
no, good. I have Sam. I'll just ask her. But I just want to say thank you.
E-bike trail.
And it's a lesson for life, though, right?
So I don't know if do we have any final words here? I don't think so. But thank you very much for coming. I'd like to call the meeting adjourned. And thank you, Tom.
Could have done one of these.
Yeah,
you've been great. Come back as our chairman.
Yeah.
Yay!
Yeah.
I nominate Tom to be chair.
Yeah. I second the motion.
I'm an employee through September 30th, and I don't plan to live in Ridgecrest until September 30th.
And Steve, thanks a lot for coming. And if you have any
more, well, we need somebody.
Yeah, well, there's a bunch there.
Okay. I didn't see him. I got
neutral
okay.
party, right?
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Are you out
of here? Is there a chance you could
Thank you.
Oh, I want to
read this during a live
I'm on vacation.
Yeah.
No,
I'm
on vacation.
Take a nap.
Go
in, Sam. You got to take Sam.
So intense.
Yeah.
I have some friends.
It's good, yeah.
Good to see you.
Somebody from the museum, probably Andrea.
Where, what?
Will be in touch. Wonderful.
Oh, we like
that. Do you have
I don't know. I just know when I was very young, I was born in Asia, and I know a name for me. My dad was
Okay.
And I was the very young. And we went up to Canada.
How did I do, Sam?
You did great.
No, thanks.
And so when I came home,
I'm worried, Sam.
I'm
worried.
I'm going to pin something. I'm going to pin something.